Okay.
I haven't passed out these the new notes. Here we go, Mr. Rowe. There's two of them.
Here.
So, next week, by the time, we'll be here for, I will be here for next week and the week after. And then Kirk will be here for the following 2 weeks after that. And I'll be back. I come back on Monday, March 24th. So that means 25th, 26th, 27th. I'll be back on March 27th. And so then we will, of course, by the time, pretty much by next week, we should begin to collect people back.
Yeah.
Right. We've lost them here. By the wayside, everybody's gone.
Betty said she just couldn't get up this morning.
No, life. See, Dick barely made it.
Yeah.
Okay, the idea.
A block and a half away.
Yeah. No, we're not going to rent a school bus to come by and pick you up. But what we want to do is to move into the understanding of. The wrath of God. And we've talked about this in another setting, in that this is the politically incorrect character trait, attribute of God, is the wrath of God. And yet what we will see is that this is really a high profile attribute that's constantly being thrown in our face, and we've got to address it. But what it does, this is where you come to the conclusion that biblical Christianity is not for the faint-hearted. It's not. So let's talk about this in our time remaining. Definition: the wrath of God can be described as the response of God to sin. By this I mean that God actively punishes those who are under his wrath unless that wrath is satisfied. And this is the idea. The concept is, it's just conceptually, you understand, God is a person. And the wrath idea is God is actively responding against sin because he is holy, righteous, just. This he cannot, I suppose, from a certain sense, we would say he can't help himself. But that really sort of seems to not be a good way to say it. But the idea is that this is just who he is. But the Bible reveals that our God is a person, and they use the term wrath. That is, it is an idea of personal response, personal vengeance, that kind of a thing. Okay? And so it's not a very pleasant thing to talk about. The problem is, and this is where on the notes under the qualifying the divine wrath, the wrath of God, is that when we think of that, the mistake we fall into, we always know this, we talk about the attributes of God, is that you cannot ever think of our God as an extension of ourselves, just like a Superman, because he's not like us in his being, so we have to make sure we qualify. So if we talk in terms of wrath, obviously we're moving into the realm of emotion, that we cannot attribute to God anything that is sinful, that we would normally attach to that emotion. So things like out of control, you know, you've lost your temper and you blew up and you gave someone a peace of mind that you cannot afford to lose. Okay, that kind of a thing. Well, God doesn't do that. He's obviously always in control. Or motive. I just fed up with somebody and I just, I dump on them. God, obviously I've done that. You know, all of that kind of thing. Well, God doesn't do that. He doesn't just get fed up in the sense everything is under control, everything perfectly reflects his character. Okay, but once you've said that, so you've removed the sinful aspects from it, like God has a holy jealousy. This is like a holy wrath. God is jealous for his name. So you have to strip away all those negative, sinful aspects of jealousy that we tend to bring to the table when we're jealous. God is jealous, but he's not jealous in those sinful ways. You're forced to kind of address this. Because remember the 1 John 1:5, in him is light, there's no darkness at all. So you cannot impugn his motives, can't do that. You cannot question his character. That is he out of control? He's just sort of frothing at the mouth. He's angry at people. No. Does it communicate anger? Yes, it does. Yes, it does. But remember in Ephesians 4, the phrase, in your anger, do not sin. So when it says that, it means that it's clearly possible to be angry and not sinful. We all, typically, most of us would say, well, that may be true theoretically, but practically, I don't quite experience that very, very often. But this is where we talk about the concept of moral outrage. Because we're made in the image of God with a sense of right and wrong, everybody exercises moral outrage over something. Something that strikes you as being just wrong. Well, now, if you believe in evolution, then there is no ultimate right or wrong. We're just a cosmic burp. You know? So there's no basis for moral outrage. And so if you pushed someone who holds to evolution to the wall and say, okay, on what basis do you determine what's right and wrong? Basically, it's societal's views, the views of society. Or, to put it in a crass way, we simply count noses every so often and say, what's right? And, of course, example, homosexuality. For a period of time, for many years, that was bad. Now, it's not bad. Okay? You know, it used to be in psychology textbooks, it used to be under abnormal psychology, no longer. No longer, okay?
When did that switch? Just out of curiosity.
Well,
textbooks probably. Yeah.
Probably, my guess is 80s, 90s?
Well, sometime after the
80s.
Mostly in the 90s.
Yeah,
probably 90s.
I was going to say sometime after the 80s, because even when I was in nursing school, and that was like up till 1980, it was in abnormal psychology.
Yeah, probably 90s, and it sounds like it.
There's the current issue of Christian Research Journal has an article on transgenderism, and the guy is a counselor who's writing this, and he says he's used to having guys who are addicted to pornography and sex offenders. He had this guy come in. He's talking about a really handsome guy. The guy had a sex change operation from being a woman to a man. Now he's become a Christian. He's asking what he's supposed to do. And in the footnote down there, it said that following what was done with homosexuality, pressure was put on the American Psychological Association, and now transgenderism or whatever has now been taken out of the list of abnormalities.
Yeah. So, but the bottom line, we ought not to be surprised at that technically is the way things are addressed, but push comes to shove, practically that's not the way people experience it. Because you may say it's politically incorrect to say homosexuality is wrong, okay, but privately, people think, weird, this is not right. I don't want, it's okay for everybody else. I don't want my kid being that way. And that's a typical response. But there is some way in which we exhibit moral outrage, things that we just think are just wrong. But if you don't believe man's made in the image of God, you've removed the basis for saying that. Because obviously you need, in order to say something is ultimately wrong, you need an absolute, so you need something above us to tell us, you need God to tell us this is wrong. Now we have an absolute, if God made everything, now we have the basis for absolutes. Well, but, so that's the idea. But everyone does have this moral outrage, okay? Everyone has it. So when we talk about, we need to talk about the wrath of God, sort of flesh it out a little bit. What we're going to do is first go into the Old Testament and then into New. Yes?
You might want to correct the...
Yes, that's right, that's right. I made that mistake. Let's see, where...
It's the second dot in qualifying the wrath of God.
Yes, on the notes. Where it says, in the case of the wrath of God, we would be referring to an expression of anger that is not out of control or sinful.
Don't want to get you in trouble with God.
No. The not was left out. It was just faux pas. Once again, it's a fallen world. You get what you pay for. And that's it.
Was leaving the not out predestined?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Am I responsible for leaving it out? Yes, I am responsible for it. So I've got to fix it. But anyways, that's the idea. Okay, let's go to the... second here. While we're doing it, I want to make a note so I can change something. Because I have to change it. At least on the... Okay, Old Testament. This is turn to Exodus 32, verses 9 and 10. Exodus 32.
This is the clean part of my Bible.
Yes. Exodus 32. Now, this is the section, the account of the golden calf. Of course, historically, we understand this. Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt, the Exodus to the Red Sea. They're now at Mount Sinai Peninsula. Mount Sinai, about 2 weeks' walk from, Promised Land. And Moses goes up on the mountain. He gets 10 commandments, talks to God. He's up there for quite a while. Meanwhile, all hell breaks loose in the camp, and they create the golden calf, false worship, etc. Things just deteriorating. Moses comes down. So that's just the general idea. And he deals with it. But in your verses 9 and 10, I have seen these people, the Lord said to Moses, and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so that my anger, that's the wrath thing, my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation. This is where we see this introduced, this concept of wrath, this anger. And so what we need, in order to grasp this, you have to grasp the concept. This is where the New Covenant theology model, if we were being in seminary, we would call it a paradigm. Maybe you've experienced a paradigm shift. That's just seminary mumbo jumbo, which is usually meaningless gibber, meaning how you need to kind of have a proper view of how the Bible hangs together. That's what you need to do. So the idea is that, remember, we talk about Israel being a temporary, unbelieving picture of the people of God. That's actually terribly important. Why? Because Israel, everybody agrees, Israel's, you read the Old Testament, Israel's called the people.
You get said in every time. You
that's know. Right.
Look at once.
Yeah.
Just while I got my mouth running here.
Yes.
What about the wrath in the garden?
Oh.
That's kind of where.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wrath? Oh, yes, yes, anger there too, yes. I just picked something that was just sort of blatantly obvious. You could go all over the place. You're right. I'm just selective. That's it. But the reason why you need to point this out is that most of our Old Testament is all about Israel, from Exodus on. Genesis is prep time, but for the nation of Israel. And then the rest is the nation of Israel. And they're called the people of God, but here God is pouring out wrath on his people. And unless you understand the correct model, that Israel's not really the people of God, only a picture and a temporary one at that, then you have problem of how will God show his wrath on you as a believer? Because you're the people of God. And we would say, no. Because he shows wrath on Israel, which he does over and over and over again, because they're not believing. That's terribly important, because otherwise it seems, you got this sort of angry parent out there who's just, he's just brutal on you. And that's not the picture, because Israel's not really the people of God. So that's the reason I brought this up, because when you talk about wrath, and the bulk of our Bible is all about Israel, you've got to make sure the Bible assumes that you understand this distinction. It assumes you understand it, which is why we call it a foundational truth, because it's sort of like the predestination thing. You can't really, it's sort of like you bump up against it either directly or indirectly virtually all the time. That's why it's a foundational truth. You can't just ignore it. Well, that's the same thing. This how the Bible hangs together, how we're to view Israel, you can't ignore it because it's just all over the Bible. So, that's I brought that up. Turn to Matthew 21.
You know the black Reformed Baptist that's on the White Horse Inn?
Yeah, okay.
He said, I was listening to one of his sermons, he says this golden calf episode is a pastor's dream. Here you've got great attendance, an involved congregation, freely giving of their money into the offering.
He's great. Yeah. You have to appreciate their White Horse Inn is... They're not remotely politically correct. And that's why you find them attractive that way. Okay, parable of the tenants. Now, we could go to any number of the parables, but we'll go to this one because this illustrates the point that we just made. Verse 33, Matthew 21, 33. Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. When the harvest time approached, he sent his servants to the tenants to collect his fruit. The tenants seized his servants. They beat one, killed another, and stoned a third. Then he sent other servants to them, more than the first time, and the tenants treated them the same way. Last of all, he sent his son to them. "They will respect my son," he said. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him and take his inheritance." So they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? Now, remember, a parable is a folksy story from everyday life that everybody can relate to. Everybody can relate to this. That it's agrarian society. They understood, investment property, guy buys a vineyard. They got all this down. Now he then appeals to them. Okay, so what should happen? "He will bring those wretches to a wretched end," they replied. Okay, so he's good. This is everybody says, yeah, beat down the bad guys. "And he will rent the vineyard to other tenants." Yeah, that's right. "Who will give him a share of the crop at the present time?" Now Jesus then just turns. Jesus said to them, "Have you never read in the scriptures? The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. The Lord has done this. It is marvelous in our eyes." Of course, now Jesus is the capstone. "Therefore, I tell you that the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given it to a people who will produce its fruit. He who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, but he on whom it falls will be crushed." When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard Jesus' parables, they knew he was talking about them. They looked for a way to arrest him, but they were afraid of the crowd because the people held that he was a prophet. Now, when it says in verse 43, "Therefore I tell you," excuse me, "that the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people who will produce its fruit." Okay, so from a point of view of New Covenant theology, since that's now you've got the proper paradigm, model of how the Bible hangs together, we understand that Israel's a temporary, unbelieving picture of the people of God, not the real thing, which is why they get thrown out of the kingdom. Because God doesn't throw the real people out of the kingdom. It just doesn't do that. I was in a small group last night at our church, and one of the guys was teaching on Romans 8, 31 to the end of Romans 8, where he says, "Nothing can separate you from the love of God. If God who justifies, who can condemn you?" Meaning it's impossible. If Jesus purchases you, you're secure in his love forever. Well, here they're getting thrown out of the kingdom. Doesn't sound like very permanent to me. Well, if you're not only a picture. Now, but notice, and it just dawned on me as I was reading this. What?
It can be dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. Notice verse 43. "Therefore I tell you that the kingdom of God will be taken away from you, given to somebody else, because it'll produce fruit." Okay? Notice how the Bible assumes, how God assumes we understand this concept of the kingdom right here. Israel they were a picture of the people of God in the picture of the kingdom, but they're claiming to be in the real kingdom, and God says, "No, I'm taking you out of that because you're really not that." In reality, they were never it in the first place. The Bible assumes you've gone through all of that sort of thinking as you've read this.
But the Jews, at that juncture, because they didn't have a kingdom at that, or an earthly kingdom at that point.
Well, they had a semblance of one.
They had no king.
Well, that's true, but that's only because they were in a period of digression.
Well, yeah, my question is, would they have been looking at that as the Messiah they thought was coming, which was an earthly kingdom?
Yeah.
They would have looked at the kingdom he's talking about as being that?
Yes.
Okay.
Right, and so they would say they had the kingdom, then they lost it, but they're going to get it back.
Get it back.
And Jesus says, of course, then when you read this, you ought to think in terms of John 3, Nicodemus, the Nick at Night thing, and you say, well, Jesus says, Nick, you're not even in the kingdom. Nick, in fact, is humanly, it's not impossible to get in the kingdom. God has to put you in the real kingdom. See, all of these texts assume you understand the model. They assume that that when you say this, this is what's going through your head. Okay, Israel's, well, no, they're not really, they weren't in the real kingdom, so they got really kicked out of the real kingdom, because that's not possible. Because they know you, Romans 8 says, that's not possible. So they're in a picture of the kingdom. They thought they were in the real kingdom, and according to their perception, God says, no, you're not anymore, I'm throwing you out. But they were never in it in the first place. All true. All true. This assumes a quite a bit of theological understanding. Just this little phrase. You understand the known because you now understand the model. And that's why, since most of the Bible has to do with Israel, even Dale's, you know, low blow comments about this, here we go again stuff, but he's true, he's absolutely correct, because it seems as though Johnny One Note, you know, always we're coming back to this, because you cannot shake it. Typically, you can't shake it because it is foundational. But you see the wrath of God that he's, you know, Israel is getting thrown out. Israel's getting thrown out. And our time is up. We're going to come back. We'll look at the ultimate text of seeing the wrath of God in the Old Testament, which is Deuteronomy 28. We will look at that and pick that up next week.
You know, without knowing this, and I mean, because of this class, and I understand a lot more of this, but it makes me read the Psalms totally differently.
Oh, yes, it does. Yes, it does. Because most of the time they're talking the Psalms of physical deliverance, not spiritual.
Yeah.
Right. And you look at it as spiritual deliverance.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some of the Psalms that I've always looked at and thought it was saying one thing, and now